position number 13586, reel 3.
Well, that varied according to the period of the year. When we went there in November, it was snow on the hills, and we were in tents, which were rather cunningly sorted out into good shelters, following the tradition of the Indian frontier. And of course, that had been copied from the Crimean War. We dug out the floor of the bell tent, except for the centre pole, where we put in two biscuit tins filled with earth and stones, and put the tent pole on that. And then we had a round area below the surface of the ground to keep the wind out. We put a channel all around the tent pegs to let the rain and water go off from there, and we put heavy stones on the edges of the tent to keep the place warm inside. Now that was a very comforting way. Of course, we wore all our kit, never took anything off. We wore everything except our equipment. Then when it got warmer, we eventually used our service dress jackets, and I wore the kilt the whole time, and so did the Camerons and the Argyles. Later on, it was so hot we had to hand all our greatcoats in, and we went reduced to a khaki drill tunic, which we only wore at night, in the evenings, and usually it happened to be cold, but sometimes it was on the hills. But our equipment was very much simpler than in France. We had to carry a small haversack on our back in battle order, as they called it, high up on your shoulders, and a water bottle at your side. And that water bottle was very important in Salonika in the heat of the day. You were only allowed one water bottle. You had to be filled when you started the march. We marched all night coming from Stavros, as I mentioned a little while ago. We marched from Stavros back to Langebuk, and that was in 90 miles. And we marched, started immediately it was dark, and marched right through the night, stopping at midnight to have a meal of biscuits and some water, which we drummed up. And I used to carry a tin of Nestle's condensed milk, which we put in. That was my drink. We bought that in the canteens, which they did allow. One or two Expeditionary Force canteens were visible around the various depots in the up country where we were. We got one such depot at Stavros. Now, then we'd march on till about 12 hours marching in all, is what we did at that time. We were across country, rough country. Then in the summer, we wore, instead of the slouch hat, we started with the slouch hat in the summer, about May and June, and it was too hot, and we then got a topi, the army's sun helmet, worn by Wolseley and the Egyptian campaign of 1884 and 5, and the Atbara and all other places on the Indian frontier. I was told when I joined the 1st Battalion, you're not a soldier unless you've worn a topi. And I was able to rejoice to those who had been said to me I wasn't a soldier, although I had been in action a lot. I say, well, I am now a soldier. I'm qualified to call myself a soldier because I've worn a topi. And I wore a topi and brought that topi home, in fact, when I came home from Salonika. Unfortunately, my father, your grandfather, your great-grandfather, threw it out in the bucket one day in Edinburgh when I wasn't at home. He was clearing out some rubbish, and I was extremely upset that my topi, which I was so proud of, was thrown out. But I wore it in the Second War. And there again, after wearing a topi in India for about a year, less than a year, 6 months, we were told to wear the Gurkha hat instead. I must say the Gurkha hat has it over all sun helmets. Sun helmets were quite unnecessary.
What happened when you went to France the second time?
Well, the second time I went to France, things were absolutely different. Much harder, conditions were worse, shelling was heavier, and everything was more difficult. And I joined again, as I joined the first war, in the middle of a battle. I joined in the middle of the Battle of Arras. And I found myself on Greenland Hill, early late in May 1917, where I showed you the Greenland Hill from the eastern front, the eastern side of it. If you remember, it was a sloping hill, bare of features, and it was just grain growing on it everywhere. There were no trees or anything of that sort. Now, the airplane photograph I showed you, the air photograph, makes it clear that every bit of that hill was pitted with shell holes, and that was June. They were all dry, but when I got to my battalion in the line at Pampu, which is just behind Greenland Hill, the commanding officer said, anybody of the 12 young officers, he said, we were posted to various companies by the adjutant, and he said, who's been out here before, and were three of us, I've been out longest, and he said, oh, you better go to join Captain Davy on D Company on the hill in Cuthbert Trench. So that was the furthest point. In fact, Cuthbert Trench had just been taken that morning from the Germans by the Northumberland Fusiliers, and we'd just taken over from them. So I went up there, and I found Captain Davies with one other officer, Jimmy Ritchie, and he was trying to clear out the trench from the dead, putting dead Germans over the top and what have you. And Captain Davies said to me, have you been out before? I said, yes, I was a sergeant at Second Leap. He said, well, then get out into the Cuthbert Trench and put it in a position of fortified, make it a front-line trench. And I said, who's this platoon sergeant? He said, a man called McDougall. So I went along on my own with a runner and got into the trench, and I found a thing about 4 foot deep, running out to about 100 yards, and then on the bare hillside it just petered out. And I found that the men were all sitting in the trench and wondering what was to happen next. So I said to Sergeant McDougall, okay, the first thing you do is to get some wire out there. And we then put out a rolls of wire which were lying about, and pegged them. And there's long grass, and we put the pegs of rolls, they were about a foot high. We made little catchment areas, so that if anyone was coming along, they'd trip over the wire. You see. And then, having got that out, we put out two or three soldiers to listen. And then we started to dig. I took my jacket off and all the others, and all the time there was a certain amount of shell fire going on, but not as heavy and intense as it had been the first time I had joined. But it was behind me. But the trouble was, it was very isolated, and I couldn't get back into the trench in the daytime, into the main trench where my friends, where the rest of the company was, because we were at an angle, Greenland Hill. This was, in fact, a communication trench, which we had to face in a different way and dig out. But they all worked like beavers, believe me. They knew that when daylight came, unless they were under cover, they were going to be shot. And we dug and we dug, and we got down to about 6 foot back. When we left the trench about a week later, we got about 9 foot in some places, and very narrow. But we had then to clear up. Once we got in there, we were able to keep observation of the Germans and way down there. They were about 400 yards away from us. We weren't near at all, and they weren't visible. But they, on the hill behind us, the top of the hill, where the Charlie Trench ended and where the company headquarters were, we saw one or two fights, dog fights, with Captain Ball, VC, a famous airman, who flew a triplane, was attacked by three Germans, and he brought them all down. And we were great excitement watching that. But, of course, two or three people were killed by bobbing their heads up, not in my trench, but in Charlie Trench, for looking at this war fight in the sky. They put their heads up, and the German snipers had caught them, because we were right on the top of the wood. Now, that Greenland Hill battle made me realize how much more offensive the war had become. Very different. Every inch of trench was dug when it could be dug, and we worked the whole time. It was June too, the same kind of month, you see, May and June, one found that the night was too short to do the work, and you had to work in the daytime. But the moment you put a spade of a shovelful of earth over the top, bullets would fly. The Germans were watching us, watching that bit of trench. And if you put a bullet over, so you had to keep it stored in the trench, dig it out, and then throw it out at night. Fill up sandbags, and you had to wait all day to get your rations, the rations to come up. And the same was a great difficulty in forming a latrine, you see. Men can't foul the trench they live in. They must go, they must fulfill nature's demand somewhere else. So you had to get a bit where they'd been blown in by a trench and put a few sandbags around it and put a mark up on it, latrine. And they get at night, the pioneers would send you up a bag of chlorine lime, and that's how you kept the place safe, because otherwise you get disease from dysentery and what have you. Mm-hmm. But that battle lasted a week. We helped to take out the Northumberland Fusiliers sent up a burial party to carry away three of their officers who were killed there. And it was high time they were taken away, because the bodies were covered with maggots, and it was a most unpleasant smell and a most unpleasant sight. Men had been brave men 2 days before, and the German bodies, we felt them in the trench. They were wobbly. You stand on the trench, a dead body, you wouldn't know it was there, but you felt them wobbly a bit, just some of the gases in the stomach, you see, and we found people with legs sticking out of the side of a trench. That kind of horror. And the whole place was surrounded us with dead Germans all around, and the smell was frightful. And the flies were getting busy then. But that, one comfort about it, it didn't rain. But that, then I, of course, had to make myself known to my platoon, and they found me there as a man who had been in the ranks and had been out, and most of them had not been out very long. And I got their confidence early on and retained it, became their company commander. In fact, Dick Fox was then a Lance Corporal in that platoon. He eventually was my platoon sergeant, as I told you. He was with me at Ypres. I don't know what happened to him after the 21st of March, because he wasn't with me then. I think he was probably home on leave. He'd been out for over 2 years, and there's a special leave arrangement made. He'd been in South Africa as a soldier, and the Cameronians, that is the Scottish Rifles. A policeman in Falkirk was his occupation. And he got a military medal as a result of the battle at 3rd Ypres, which I recommended him for a decoration, and he got a gold watch and chain from the Corporation of Falkirk, which is a very great pleasure and joy to us all after Ypres, that one of our people, very few awards were given. There were two, my Sergeant Davy, my signalling sergeant, got an MM, military medal, and as you know, I collected a military cross at Ypres.
Today's Christmas Day, but what was Christmas Day like when you were fighting?
Well, Christmas Day 1915... 1940, of course, I was at home. 1915, I was in Salonika, and I was working hard with my platoon on making a road from the docks up to Lemberts, where was the camp. And we spent a very ordinary Christmas that year. 1916, I was home from Salonika and spent my Christmas at Gale's camp, the officer's cadet training unit, and had a very happy Christmas. 1917, I was in the trenches at a place known as Foster Avenue, on to the west of Fontaine-les-Creuselles, on the hill. Now, you remember Fontaine-les-Creuselles, because you went to it, I think. Well, on the hill facing it from the west side, we were in a large trench called Foster Trench, which looked down on Fontaine-les-Creuselles. It was only about 400 yards away. And there we were in the line, and it was a very ordinary Christmas, and shooting went on just as usual, a little less than usual, but it was you didn't show yourself, put your head above the parapet, or you get shot at. So there was no great joy and pleasure there, but of course we were a Scottish regiment, and we celebrated our Hogmanay a week later, when we were out of the line at a little place called Berle-au-Bois, a village just near the Somme, which was quite habitable, and we lived in barns, and we had a real setup. That was the finest one we had. Then the following year, 1918, of course, I was back out of the army. 1918, I was back in the Ministry of Labour, back at my ordinary peacetime job. That was a ball. But many people had other experiences. In December 1914, of course, the Guards, and amongst other, and some Scottish regiments, the Argylls, fraternized with the Germans in No Man's Land. There was a great row about it. And there were people getting into serious trouble for allowing it to happen. But they couldn't prevent the Jocks and the Germans at that time of the war, stage of the war, stopping fighting for Christmas Day. Well, that was just very interesting that, in fact, I only had one good Christmas. It was a Hogmanay, really.
Did the enemy ever raid your trenches?
Oh, yes. Not as often as we raided them. That was a regular practice in the British Army during all the war, was to try and obtain domination in no man's land. And that meant sending out people on patrol, and I'll tell you about that later. But raids, yes. We, in tunnel trench, which you've seen the phrase, when we took it over about early in March, or late February 1918, We'd only been in the line a couple of days, and as I said, we had to evacuate. The front line was full of water. And about the second day we were in the line, a German officer was captured. It stuck in the wire just on his side of our trench, And he was brought in by our patrol, who had rescued him from the wire. He was caught by his boots and the gore, and mixed up in the wire and couldn't get out of it. His patrol had run away and left him there, and he was brought in. He was taken to me, and I took him down to Tunnel Trench, and I gave him a glass of whiskey. And he was very pleasant. He could speak English, and he was a Bavarian. And when I was a second lieutenant, and he asked, was I a platoon commander? I said, no, I was a company commander. In which case, he immediately drew attention and saluted me and called me Hoffmann, captain, the German name. Now, he was very well dressed. He had no papers on him, nothing at all. He had a pistol. That was all. It was taken from him, of course, by the soldiers who took him prisoner. And he was sent down under guard to interrogation and went back to a prisoner of war camp. Now, he was a very pleasant chap, and I liked him. He was a man of my own age, a young man, and who was a regular soldier. Well, we wondered what this meant. Nothing happened until about 3 days later, when just as we were about to stand to, the evening stand to, a box barrage fell on the line, part of the line. Now, a box barrage is a series of bursting shells in the shape of a box, but the centre of which was our tunnel trench. So on each side, about 200 yards on each side of our where we were located, we saw a line of trench of shells bursting from north to south and others from east to west. And we were inside that. Well, at once we stood to, got out of the trench and got into the shell holes and looked. We could see now the shells were bursting, and some of them were falling into our trench, but we were all right. We had no casualties. This lasted for about 20 minutes. And then, as suddenly as it started, it stopped for half an hour. It stopped. And I took stock. We went round, and we saw where all the damage had been done. Incidentally, I never told you yesterday that the tunnel trench was about 15 feet wide, enormously wide, and you couldn't fire out of the trench because it's about 10 feet high. But there were the little places for firing were on the top. You had to climb up the trench, or sometimes on ladders, and get out of the trench that way, because it was all so badly shelled. Well, this tunnel trench, there was plenty of damage done, but it didn't matter, because the whole place was shelled. But we walked down to my front line, and we saw that the wire had been blown in by the Germans, and we found a collection of stick grenades. They were like potato champers, we call them, tatty mashers. They were tied together. The stick bombs of the Germans, you pulled a string from the foot of them, and they were tied in half dozens, and the strings were pulled, thrown into the wire, and with the explosion of stick, they blew the wire away. Well, we saw places where the Germans had been through the wire, but others where the bombs hadn't gone off. And we walked along our front, and then we came to our neighbouring, the right flank company, C Company, and I found a patrol of an officer there, and he said, have you lost any men? And I said, no, I haven't. My men are all right. He said, what about you? He said, I've lost 15 men. They're taken prisoner. And I said, how was that? Oh, he said, they were sheltering in the trench, and the Germans came along from your end. I said, well, who was on guard? And they said, well, I don't know, but they were taking shelter where the box barrage was on, and they were just nipped out. So I then went back, reported to the company headquarters, to battalion headquarters by telephone, and the adjutant came up, and the colonel came up, and the next day the brigadier came up. And Rawson, who was the captain commanding the company on my right, was very indignant and said that I had left his left flank exposed. But as I had told my battalion when I took over the line, I was unable to take over the front line because it was full of water, and I couldn't account, I wasn't taking on responsibility for stores of ammunition, things supposed to be in because they were all underwater. The battalion headquarters knew, and he knew, that I wasn't there, and he should go after his own left flank. So the brigadier came up, and I hadn't seen a brigadier in the line since Sanctuary Wood, but the brigadier was in the line once. This was the first time I had seen the brigadier. And then in the afternoon, I think the same day, the divisional commander came and said, why had there been a raid on us at this our battalion? Well, the battalion had lost 15 men taken prisoner, and about three men were killed, and about half a dozen wounded in this company, in the centre company. And they were on the flank of the box barrage. Now, that was a shock for the battalion. It was the first time it had lost soldiers taken prisoner in that fashion. And I was congratulated by the divisional commander for having had the sense to pull out of the morass. And so I was quite happy about it all. We were lucky, we were raided all right, but we didn't lose anybody, simply because the conditions were so terrible that no raiders could make progress through the quagmire. And it was just a short, sharp raid. Well, of course, later, 21st of March occurred, so obviously they were probing to see who were in the line. And they'd got prisoners, so they must have known who we were in the line. They could identify the regiments, and that's the object of the exercise when you carry out a raid, to get an identification. Now, I can tell you of another case of that sort, where at Harjiko, which is another battle, where we took prisoners. We got the identification of the prisoners. I was with Sergeant Fox at Harjiko, which is down near the south extreme right, about August, month of August the year before, 1917. And I was doing a lot of patrolling. We all had to do patrolling then, to get the command of No Man's Land, which was a very wide No Man's Land, about a thousand yards. And there were no shell holes about this place. It was absolutely undisturbed country. But there, we got up to the... we used to patrol into the German front line. There was nobody in it. The German front line was held by one watchman and a night watchman and a dog. That was our idea. We walked along that front line inside the trench and found nobody, but we'd hear them coming down from the support line. And so we quickly got back over the line. But on this occasion, we were told to get an identification. And Fox, myself, and two other chaps were lying on a place called the Buisson Ridge. And we lay in the dark, it was dark, getting darkish, and we got as close to the German wire as we could, and we heard German voices, and a German came out and loomed over our head, going past us. And Dick Fox got out of the shell hole, he was a big man, 6 foot tall, and brought his knob kerry, he had a knob kerry, like a club with studs on it, right smack on the fellow's head, and brought him down. And he took his pay book off his office and his shoulder straps, which showed his regiment, the 2nd Württembergers. And then we got where the Germans then started to shout. They heard this fellow fall, they started to open fire, and we lit out for home as hard as we could. We were really fired on coming into our own trenches. Then we got an identification, because the raiding is one of the things which both sides use, but the purpose was the same, was to identify them.
What about Harjiko?
Well, Harjiko was a little set-piece battle for one brigade, and it occurred on the 26th of August 1917. Harjiko was on the extreme right of the British line, or almost on the extreme right, and we were in the trenches there for about a couple of months, and we were patrolling actively, and we knew that the first three lines of enemy trenches were not occupied in any strength all the time. And it was decided that the brigade should attack this ridge, because Harjiko was in a shallow hollow, a small town, and the enemy held the trenches on the eastern slopes of the hill, and on the crest of the hill you could look down onto their main roads, and we were keen to get an observation on their main road behind the equivalent of Tunnel Trench. Well, I was out every night, I think, for 2-3 weeks. Rather than do trench duty, I was a platoon commander at Harjiko, and the usual tour of duty was that you spent so many hours on and off in the trench with the NCOs and the men, or if you did a night patrol, you were excused duty during the daytime, and I preferred to be excused duty in the daytime and go out and patrol. Many people didn't like going on patrol. I found it better, and so did some of my friends, because you weren't shelled when you were on patrol. You could at least have a chance to see your enemy. Well, we used to go out without any equipment on, just a revolver and a couple of bombs in our pockets. And we didn't wear steel helmets. And we had our faces blackened, and had soldiers' cap comforter, they called it, on our heads, which we put over our ears. And we went out to listen and find out the movement of the enemy. Well, we discovered all that Harjiko, all about the facts of the enemy, and in fact we made our attack eventually. But before we did it, we practiced it behind the lines when we were out on rest on a facsimile drawn out on the ground. We had a model made, and everybody came and saw where his platoon should be and what we should do. We then had a full-scale model built made out in a field, and spitlock trenches, that's take the turf off to mark where the trenches were, and we rehearsed it about half a dozen times, and in order to simulate the barrage, we had the drummers advancing in front of us, beating the drums, and the signals waving their flags, And that represented, over 100 yards in front of us, that represented the British barrage when it was fall, when it would fall. And we were therefore taught to keep as close to the barrage, 100 yards as near as you could go, to allow you to get to the enemy trench before the enemy bobbed up from their shelters to fire at you. Well, we rehearsed this very thoroughly, and it was a very good exercise. Then the day of the battle, it was a nice day, it was a Sunday morning, and we set off, and we got through the first two free lines of the enemy trenches without any trouble. When we got to the fourth, we found ourselves being edged off to the left because the people on our right, the battalion on our right, had been hit by liquid fire, which is the most appalling thing. Shells which ignited, rather like the naphtha bombs they had in Vietnam. But these igniting bombs, what they call them, phosphorus bombs, and liquid fire, were terrifying. And the people naturally cleared from them. They pushed us all to the left. So we found ourselves going haywire on this, on the final assault on the last trench. Anyhow, we took the place. But before we went to the battle, held it for 3 days and then were relieved. But before we went into the battle, my platoon sergeant asked me, before we left Roiselle, which was where we were billeted, before going the 7 mile march up to the trenches for the assault, he said, I am afraid I'm not coming through this, sir. And I said, what, sergeant, what nonsense. You came through Arras and you came through the Somme, and why should you think anything about this? This is a small attack compared. He said, I'm not going to live through this. He said, will you write to my wife if I don't come back? And I promised to do so and try to poo-poo his ideas of his fears. But to no avail, he was in fact killed on the second day. And I had to write to his wife. Now, I've met other cases where that happened, where men have said, well, I won't see this one through. I'm glad to say I never had that kind of premonition. But probably the older men might have better thoughts than I had. I was concerned on getting through the battle and doing well. And my platoon were good. I liked them. I had, unfortunately, I had quite a number of casualties. We advanced from over the top in our last assault in four single files. Two of them forward, divided 50 yards apart, and two in the rear, 50 yards apart. And there was one behind the other. And that was to present a small target to the enemy. But the enemy were there all right in time, and they shot down all my machine gun, my Lewis gun platoon section. I had two men killed six wounded. In that section alone, it was wiped up all for one man. I got into the trench. I was on the right side, on the right-hand side. The Lewis gun section was on the left-hand side. I got in safely into the trench and gathered my men around me, but found I had no Lewis gunners at all. Anyhow, the assault was good and successful. But one thing has always stayed in my mind about that particular battle was the march to the front line. Usually, the troops going up the trenches are fairly cheerful, and there's always a certain amount of badinage going on, and marching at ease. Men talk, are allowed to talk, and you hear a lot of good things, good jokes, and sometimes somebody plays a mouth organ, and things were quite happy. But on this occasion, the march of 7 miles, there wasn't a sound uttered. It impressed one enormously. Not a sound was heard. Everybody was deep with his own thoughts, and probably some of them may have had the thoughts that Sergeant McDougall had, that he wouldn't come back, and he didn't come back. But Housie Corps was a very minor exercise, a brigade exercise. One man got the VC in it, a sergeant of the Lincolns, who were on our left flank, who held a bombing post against the enemy alone for about 10 hours. He was isolated, and he had boxes of bombs all around him, and he was in a very strong position, and a very strong cricketer. But he never recovered from that battle. He had to be sent home afterwards. His nerves all went to pieces. But he was a very gallant man, and he held the left flank of the attack very successfully against the counter-attacking Germans. It was a place I took you to, Housie Corps, but it's been changed by building and things like that. And it wasn't possible to locate the trenches on the spot, although I had the maps which I'd used in the battle.
What about Somerville Wood, then?
Well, that followed the Battle of Housie Corps, and it was a very interesting place because it was extreme right of the British line. on the right-hand side of on our right flank, the French were at the little stream at a little town, a little village called Pontruy, P-O-N-T-R-U-E, and the country was absolutely unsupported, no signs of war in it. There were no trenches visible on our side. We were in little section posts, rather the sort of thing which happened in the Second War. These posts were located on the edges of woods, and of course there was arable land which wasn't growing anything during the war between them. And our sister, the no man's land was about 1,200 yards wide in our particular part, and we were in three or four section posts, a platoon post, and company headquarters in a tumulus. I think we went to the tumulus where the company headquarters had been. Now, in the tumulus, you see, you've got cover from view, and you could dig a slip trench and get cover from fire if you had to, and you were in a position to dominate the enemy who approached the open ground between the woods. It was a series of woods with open fields. But there was one place called Somerville Wood, which was the most forward of these woods, nearest the enemy. And it was always a race every night. It was this market. It was in the month of July. To get to the east side of the wood before the Germans got there from their trenches, which were about the same distance away from where we were from the wood. And this was always a fighting patrol, and they made it a platoon strong, which is far too many people to take out on a fighting patrol. We found that from experience. We used to start from in the red wood, a square wood, which was square wood it was called, which was only about 200 yards away from Somerville Wood. It was on high ground, and we had to cross the high ground, get into the back of Somerville Wood, and proceed round the wood, converging on the far point, the most easterly point. And once we were there, we hoped we could see the German lines, bright moonlight night, we could see where the German trenches were, about 800 yards away.